are brought to you by the Permaculture Institute of North America or PINA. If you support permaculture across the North American continent, then please consider becoming a PINA member today at PINA.in. I'm Jesse, and I will be your host for today's summit. Our next presenter is the awe-inspiring Andrew Faust, presenting on the subject of bioregional economies. Andrew is one of North America's premier permaculture teachers and designers with over two decades of experience in the field. A visionary educator, Faust began his career as a certified alternative school teacher in Upatina's Open Community High School in Glenmore, PA, where his passion mind-expanding curriculum inspired students and educators alike from 1992 to 2001. In 1999, he launched a self-directed permaculture PhD project, an off-grid straw bale educational center in Pocahontas County, West Virginia. After moving to Brooklyn in 2007, he began applying his deep knowledge of permaculture to the urban landscapes, helping to inspire the acclaimed film Inhabit and creating a life-changing permaculture design certification course with thousands of graduates. He received a dual diploma in design and education from the Permaculture Institute of North America in 2016. Alongside his partner, Adriana Magana, and their daughter, Juniper, he runs the Center for Bioregional Living in Ellingville, New York, a hands-on campus that offers immersive education and design services for students and clients alike. Andrew is also a founding member of the team at Permaculture Living Lands Trust, a nonprofit land trust co-evolving a new commons with agroforestry and permaculture design in the eastern deciduous forest biome and beyond. Welcome, Andrew. So great to have you here.
Thank you, Jesse. Thanks for going through that whole bio.
Yeah, no, I know. And I'm sure I left stuff out, too.
That's quite an intro. I really appreciate it.
Well, you've been at it for a long time doing really great work. And I didn't even mention your book, but I assume you will be mentioning your book. So I'll let you do that. Yeah. But it's so wonderful to have you here, Andrew. We're really looking forward to this. As I told you ahead of time, I ask every presenter the same question. And the question is, most people tend to think of, if they think of permaculture, they tend to think of it as relating to the land, the garden, the landscape. But we know that permaculture also relates to like community dynamics. So speak to us about that really quickly. How do you like think of permaculture as relating to community building or community development?
I think it applies to anything that you'd like to apply it to, because it's broadly speaking, I tend to approach it, and a lot of teachers do, as a design process, that it's a way of thinking, that it's a way of organizing, that it's a interdisciplinary process, that we can put together a lot of moving parts and have them become more coordinated and interconnected through the design process in particular. And I think that that is the real strength of permaculture, is that ability to come into any landscape, any set of circumstances, and find that the principles and the ethics and the values of permaculture are part of what create a connective web of potentially more beneficial interrelationships, how to arrange the elements in such a way that there are meaningful and valuable interconnections between all those different elements. So at a community level, I think personally what I relate to that question is the emphasis that I've taken in practicing and in applying and in teaching permaculture has been to scale up the context of the conversation for how to think about what we're wanting to engage in permaculture design. That when we think about a community, I'm thinking about a set of individual human beings and the whole web of life that that human community lives in relationship with, and to have a sense of how do we configure the community in such a way that it is well suited to where it's located. And what permaculture brings to community, in my sense as a designer, is not so much the interpersonal interworkings of a community as much as it is about the context within which that community lives, and can also serve very usefully, in my understanding of it, as a way for the community to organize behavior to be coordinated. So it can create an organizing principle around which communities can achieve a collaborative framework that they can scaffold many different phases and scopes and scales of work throughout their community, whether it's endeavors like pursuing food security or achieving greater social equity or addressing the very topical issue that we hear a good bit about these days, which is housing and how to address these questions that are pretty widespread, often recurring questions that come up for communities, is going to be around food security, is going to be around social well-being, and how do we improve those things, and what permaculture brings to that kind of fundamental human imperative of improving human well-being and improving the overall equity and quality of life for the entire society, for all individuals and all members of that community, that how we achieve that is in part a tangible and physical and knowable thing, which is how good is our physical infrastructure? How well are we set up in this popular, but I think not well understood in other disciplines, term resilience, that is often sort of bandied about as much of what we'll hear climate concerns be pushing this conversation around. What does it mean to be resilient? I often find that it isn't defined and it's left loose and open-ended. And it is the kind of thing that, in my opinion, permaculture is uniquely suited to define it and to give a very straightforward game plan in terms of how is it achieved. And so when we talk about community resilience at a kind of design scale, there are practical means by which we achieve that. And there are also the organizational, the more intangible means, or what I was starting out there referring to is the process by which a permaculture design, let's say, for a community can be for a broad community, which has been my interest and what my book, Earth is Our Home, is about, is what does it look like to organize at a regional level with permaculture design as a guiding principle in that organizing for a goal of achieving greater food security and greater energy security at a watershed or bioregional scale. What does that look like? And part of what my interest in that as a designer and as a teacher and to bring to our culture and our society at large is that I think that permaculture is uniquely suited to this goal of achieving greater regional autonomy in a way that is resilient, that offers security, that offers a way in which we can begin to truly structure and organize at a community scale what is going on with land use. Because when we look at development, when we look at what's done with real estate in the United States in particular, which is where I'm mostly familiar with it, but certainly all around the world, but in this country, it gets really into a lot of things happen that are just botched ideas because there really isn't often much of a plan when it comes to what's going on with land use. Like, specifically to ground this in a real, you know, context here in Ulster County, in the Rondout watershed, where we are in Center for Bioregional Living in Ellenville. The Rondout is a sub watershed of the Hudson. We're about an hour and a half from New York City. And you know, like every place in this country, there's a trash problem here. And the trash problem here is causing the county to right now be in the theater of the absurd of trucking about 12 to 13 tractor trailer loads of trash every day to a site 3 hours north of the county in Seneca Falls, and Seneca Falls is going to close its permit. So the county is now prospecting for right in our neighborhood, possibly locating a landfill. And what's that doing is it's creating an impetus for people to actually organize and realize, you know, because sadly, but sometimes positively, crisis brings people together in ways that before there was something, before there was a fire to put out, they were just sort of doing their thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, and simultaneously, we've got another municipality next to us, which is in the county of Sullivan. I'm sort of drawing the county line, imaginary line there. And over there, we've got water shortages because of overdevelopment. And so you have these are two like ways of basically saying in a thumbnail sketch as an answer to the question about why do I think it's important to think about organizing and planning at a community scale with permaculture design.
Yeah.
It's because of the way in which I see as a person experiencing the daily realities of what goes on with land use in the United States, and especially with, you know, our latest 3 years as a 501c3 with Permaculture Land Trust. We've shortened our name.
Oh,
we dropped the living because we decided it was a little bit much.
The mouthful.
Yeah, it's more words than are needed. Permaculture is already a mouthful.
Yeah.
So Permaculture Land Trust. But point being that very much that is a topic that I have interest, history, experience in. And so when you really begin to think more deeply about what happens with land and you want to have an influence on it, which I'm ambitious that way, I like to think that we can do that by getting out in front of it.
Mm.
And what you'll see has been the pattern in the environmental movement, in much of the activist movement, and in much of the land trust world and the watershed world, is often to be the putting out the fires scenario.
Yeah.
There's consistently some battle that they're trying to win against some developer, some bad actor, some bottling company, or somebody just shows up that the community either wins a fight with some legal assistance against or doesn't win. Either scenario, the organization may continue to stick around and has an existence that exists beyond that crisis that brought them into being. But as a synopsis, what I'm getting at there is that we don't have a lot of forward-thinking, broad-scale planning that isn't simply about business as usual, but in a way that tries to make it more reasonable in terms of how it happens or where it happens, right?
Yeah.
And what I find is that a lot of bioregionalism is largely used as an organizing principle. It's a way to organize groups. It's a way to organize communities. It's a way for state agencies to organize data. So I'll show some maps here and examples in a little bit of how this is clearly the precedent that we'll find if you just start using the web, using the internet to go search and say, you know, maps of bioregions. What you'll find is that 9 out of 10 of them are made by government agencies to keep track of things like water quality or soil quality, right?
Yeah.
And then it's also used to collect information, to organize information about ecosystems, what makes them distinct, to create basically graphic representations of distinct patterns that are definable, that exist between geographic as well as biological situations throughout the continent, that it's sliced into these bioregions. But what I'm doing with it that's unique and distinct, and I think, you know, in my opinion, needed, is this tendency often in watershed groups and in bioregionalism to, in essence, continue the work of existing environmental movements and organizations, which is the work of resisting industry,
yes,
resisting poor behavior, trying to bring it into compliance. But no, it's more than 9 out of 10 that have no vision. Their vision is no pollution.
Right.
That's great.
Stop the bad guy.
Let's just all stop polluting today. But like, how do we get there? And this is what I think is so useful about what permaculture design brings to the hard work of the environmental movement, of the social justice movement, has a lot of human integrity to it. What it is lacking that permaculture brings to those concerns is the intellectual capacity to say, let's leapfrog past the thing that we all agree upon, which is that this shouldn't exist any further. And let's get into what is our solution set that we can start to get people excited about rallying around and organizing their behaviors around and beginning to actually have a master plan for land use that is about benefiting the local population and future populations who move there. But in essence, creating a scenario that is creating a healthier life for all in the places where they reside, right? By creating bioregional or watershed scale master plans for land use that are goal oriented to achieve greater food security and greater energy security.
Yep. What an answer to that short question, Andrew. That was an amazingly comprehensive, but it really actually, I'm not trying to just like be silly, but like you really painted the broad vision, which is why I wanted to have you on this summit. And actually why you're first, this is the first presentation people will be seeing, is to give it this broadest impact and view as we possibly can. Yeah. And kind of what you're talking about in the margins there is how to have that scaffolding drive economic activity too. And that's really the title of your topic. So why don't you launch into it? I'll be in the background if you need anything, but go ahead and share screen. And thanks, Andrew, again. This is going to be great.
Okay. Thanks, Jesse. Yeah, let me share some images like I was referring to there. For me, many of my students will know this is where I always start, because I think to define bioregions, to define permaculture design and the principles and why and how they work, why they're compelling, I always like to get into this like brief, not protracted, but important backstory, which is we're on a planet in outer space circling a sun. We're spinning at 1,000 miles per hour east. We're traveling in our orbit around the sun at 67,000 miles per hour. I first learned that number in Buckminster Fuller's A Manual for Spaceship Earth. And I realized when I read that book, Bucky says, well, there is no manual for Spaceship Earth. He says there's basically no operating manual for Spaceship Earth. And as I like ruminated reading in the bathroom Bucky's insights, I thought, you know, actually there is. And it's permaculture design. Permaculture design is the operating manual for Spaceship Earth. It's the means by which we can really, as a species, begin to say, how do we collectively organize our behavior in such a manner that it makes sense for how the planet works? And that's how I like to frame what's the big picture vision that we're leaning into in permaculture design. It's designing adaptive modalities for human existence on this planet. And the more we understand about the planet and ourselves, the better a job we can do at designing appropriately for the conditions within which life will prosper, the conditions that the planet can already teach us about by virtue of the fact that life stays in the ocean for 4 billion years, right? And doesn't come onto the land till the last 500 million. And that's an important clue for good design, because the ocean embodies it, and we can get a good key in on what we're doing with living systems on the land from what living systems already found very hospitable in the ocean, right? The ocean is a great example of what good design is. The Earth, you know, this is an infrared photograph from NASA. The Earth's heating up. We all know that. It's been heating up. It turns out Lynn Margulis, who we know is an incredibly advanced and intelligent scientist who wrote a book called Microcosmos, 4.5 Billion Years of Microbial Evolution. Lynn and Dorian Sagan, if you're not familiar with them as permaculture thinkers, an important part of your lexicon. Dorian wrote a book called Into the Cool. Dorian Sagan is evidently Carl Sagan's son, as well as Lynn Margulis is his mother, and quite an innovative thinker. And he coins the term negentropy. And he says, you know, biological life is actually counterspinning the second law of thermodynamics, because what it's doing is not allowing energy to degrade into heat, which is what under the second law and inevitably degrades into lesser and lesser ordered states over time. In the Earth system, biology is counterspinning that second law because it is taking the heat from the sun and it is using it to grow more of itself. It is taking solar income and applying that to proliferate, to adaptively speciate and radiate around the entire planet's surface. And we also know that what life has been doing is increasing in ever orders of complexity over time, right? And accelerating in that ecological complexity, even accounting for all the extinctions that have happened over the last several hundred million years, we're still at a larger degree of eco-complexity than ever before in Earth's history. We also know that who does the best job at keeping the planet cool, according to Lovelock, Margulis, and NASA, is, and I think this is particularly useful for listeners who want to really key in on what are the design mechanisms that permaculture is recommending in terms of who do we need to ally with extensively and comprehensively around the entire planet. Mature, diverse ecosystems. And this is a pattern that scales up to helping to keep the planet able to provide us with a cool and comfortable ride as we rocket around a massive thermonuclear furnace that is about 97 million miles away. Right. The only thing that keeps the Earth habitable is biology, not technology. Biology is what we need to be aligning with and helping to become mature, diverse ecosystems, not monocultures of hybrid pines for pulp and paper in Louisiana. Right. That does not do the best job at keeping the planet cool. A mature, diverse ecosystem does. So as we retrofit the industrial system, rather than spending a lot of time explaining the problems with it, I would go back and forth to explain first what's the direction of what I'm recommending and outlining in my book, Earth is Our Home, which I've published, self-published primarily as my contribution to the permaculture community and the bioregional community from my 30 years of working as a professional in the education field, is also in the worlds of conservation, land trusts, and in the world of ecological design and permaculture. It's a synthesis of those strengths of bioregionalism as an organizing principle. I've been calling my work as a teacher the Center for Bioregional Living since 1996, when I started my Center for Bioregional Living newsletter at Upatinas to attract students to that program who wanted to study permaculture and bioregional design. And in that class, in that series, I made three courses: Humans from Earth, which is about how to design sustainable human civilizations. These are semester-long curriculums that I created. The second one, Transforming Worldviews, which is about how do we basically diffuse the brainwashing of the media and the propaganda machine and create our own propaganda for our own agenda. That's Transforming Worldviews. And looking a lot at that time at Adbusters, National Boycott Quarterly, Third World Resurgence, Vandana Shiva, people like that, Gerrymander, you know, 11 Arguments for the Elimination of Television. And really, so teaching media literacy. And then a third class, which is bioregionalism. Let's take students out, high school students out, because we're in the burbs. We're going to take them out in a van, and we're going to go work at an organic diversified CSA. We're going to go work in a biodynamic orchard. We're going to go work with Artie Yateman, an older Quaker guy who helped start Birthright Center, which is part of School of Living, so that they could see natural building. He was building an earthworm passive solar house. It was from teaching all these different things that I realized I didn't see all that stuff on one site. And as Jesse was saying, that was why I went down to Pocahontas County, West Virginia, and created a site so I could get a hands-on experiential knowledge in the things that I was fortunate enough to learn about from Peter Bain, and from Chuck Marsh and Patricia Allison, who I studied with at the farm in 1996. And so I went down to create my own Permaculture Educational Center and called that project Center for Bioregional Living in West Virginia. And then took that name with me both onto the web with my website being called that, as well as to New York City. And after teaching permaculture in New York, I really became focused on urban applications and regional applications. And so taking maps like these were a way that I can begin to say, what does it look like to scale up permaculture design? And so this is we're zooming in on the Northeast, right? So right here is a bioregional map. Quick back history on bioregionalism, which I like to do, because I find sometimes it's sort of fuzzy where this term starts, but there is a definite distinct historic origin of where the term starts in the Western academic world, right? Which it's idiosyncratic to, and I think is important to acknowledge often with sciences. They're treated as if they're this universal aha, but they're very culturally specific. And science, also to qualify it, I use a lot of it. I think it's a really powerful tool. But I like this phrase that Jerry Manders offers us about tools. He says, a tool is useful insofar as we recognize its limitations. And that's important to recognize with science as well. It's useful. There's a lot of things, and I acknowledge the potency of intuition and introspection. I get skeptical of fuzzy logic when we start to talk about cleaning up contaminated water by meditation, or more what I see as intangible ways, sort of magical thinking ways. I understand the need for us all to find levity in these dire times that we're in, but I'm not necessarily going to say, okay, we're going to clean up PCBs in the Hudson with good feelings, right? There's a line there. So with that said, a lot of science I find to be super useful. And I think probably if you're going to err on the side of too much of one thing in permaculture and how you frame it, too much science is not a bad way to go, because it is the religion of the society that we're in. And to impart belief, grounding it in a lot of strong science is really useful. So bioregionalism comes out of the Western academic world, early 1900s. We've got a guy, his name's Isaiah Bowman. He's a friend of J. Russell Smith, who's much more familiar in the permaculture community, because J. Russell Smith, right, writes Tree Crops, 1924, A Permanent Agriculture. And J. Russell Smith is a professor at Columbia University. And they both use this term, bioregional. This map, in fact, is from another book called Cultural and Natural Areas that came out of University of Berkeley. And they're taking bioregions are an actual, they're called physiographic provinces in 1924. And physiographic provinces is a more explicit description of what they are, because physiography is two sciences coming together. Physical geology and geography combined. That's what physiographic provinces are. They are what you're looking at is a map that shows places in the North American continent that are both physical geological wise. That's a derivation of that, but you get what I'm saying. And geographically, physical geology and the geography share similar soils, similar hydrology, similar wild animal and plant communities. They are distinct and definable, just as watersheds are. I remember one interesting anecdotal. I had a colleague who's a very educated environmentalist in a panel I was on say, you know, I don't really know, are watersheds actually truly definable? And I was kind of baffled by it. I was like, yeah, they're 100% truly definable. That's why when you're on a road, there'll be a sign that says you are now entering the Delaware River watershed. It's not because it's like it was back there, actually. It's not abstract where watersheds are, right? Same with bioregions. It's not abstract. They're definable. So here we're zooming in on the map I use a lot when I present because I'm in this part of the country. And so I like to show, this map says a bunch of things in one image. One of the things I want to share with this group in this discussion today, which is highlighting the term bioregion. What this has primarily been used for, again, I think is interesting and of note, which is that bioregions as a construct. So also quick back note, the term morphs from physiographic and physiographic provinces into the term bioregion. Late 60s into the mid 70s, all the way into the 80s and 90s, the term is bioregion. Peter Berg, the Shasta Trinity Range, this is primarily the hotbed of bioregionalism in North America, right? It's not like there's a lot of people using this word. It's always been an obscure word, more obscure than permaculture, definitely more obscure nowadays than regenerative, but becoming a phrase that's on the rise again, which is why we're talking about it, right? So ecoregion became the term, late 90s, early 2000s. For the people who use this term technically is what I'm saying. What I mean by that distinction is that there are people who associate with the term bioregionalism, bioregional, more as a subculture, not necessarily science nerds who are conservation biologists, right? But when you look at it in the professional field, this is primarily the discipline that people who use the term bioregion in the 70s and 80s, they were primarily professional biologists with a few people like myself in the permaculture community who were using it also in a sort of subculture sense to define how what you were doing was not just permaculture, but that it was at a broader kind of ecological planning perspective or application, right? Bioregionalism. So then the term in the professional field morphs into ecoregion. And main people who are using it are the EPA, Environmental Protection Agency, or if you can see down at the bottom of this image, left-hand corner, it's TNC. We've got the Nature Conservancy. And also an interesting thing that's evidenced by this map, as I said, which has a lot of meaning behind it, as I'll unpack it for you, you'll get a sense of that, which is that this image was used by the Nature Conservancy. This is an internal document that I pulled off of a PDF that they had online showing how they had organized fundraising to buy a 5,000 acre stretch of land in the part of the map that you're seeing highlighted in orange, which is the Xiaowangunk or Xuangum mountain range, which we live adjacent to. Center for Bioregional Living is just inside of the High Allegheny Plateau on the western side of the Xiaowangunk ridgeline. If you just went over the Gunks, Lake Minnewaska, you'd be in New Paltz, which is well known for rock climbing and where the mountain range earned its name, common name, the Gunks. And then you'd be in a very extensive, one of the largest physiographic provinces and bioregions in the country, which is the lower New England Northern Piedmont. And you can see that stretches quite a distance. We're getting all the way down into Maryland and parts of Virginia with the lower New England Northern Piedmont, and it goes all the way up into Vermont. And what these are showing are places to remind us, right? They're showing us places that share similar soil, similar hydrology, similar plant and animal communities. And what this means is that when you cross that mountain range that's highlighted in orange, there are endemic species that exist on the edge of ecoregions or bioregions, that don't exist right in the middle of either of the two bioregions that are on either side of that edge or that perimeter, right? So there are life forms that live in the gunks that don't live in the middle of the High Allegheny Plateau and that don't live in the middle of the lower New England Northern Piedmont. That was a compelling argument for the Nature Conservancy to use to get people to donate literally to the tune of millions of dollars to be able to buy up those mountains and turn it into a park. And this kind of thing is important because this is what I'm keen on with Permaculture Land Trust and Earth is Our Home, my book, are keying in together to the objective of how do we capitalize, how do we really make use of that strength that organizations like the Nature Conservancy have, a multi-billion dollar international organization, with the strengths of permaculture design, which doesn't have nearly that kind of wealth capital behind it, but has a much broader comprehensive solution set and vision than conservation groups do. Conservation groups are doing the important work. They're putting out the fires. They're protecting land. Now we step into the mix and we can add to that potential cluster of protected areas. How do we reconnect them to each other? How do we help local farmers have access possibly to land that the Nature Conservancy has put under easement? Could that land become part of the local food system, right? And interestingly, right as we're asking these questions of places like land trusts, they're all beginning to realize that that is something they're interested in. And they don't necessarily have the know-how and are very interested in collaborating with you often in coming up with some good ways for them to do that, ways for them to organize how to make their land available for farming and other sustainable land uses, right? Because they have the assets now and they've begun to realize, like, it's in many cases there are missed opportunities in terms of what they're doing with their land assets. They've got a lot of land. Not all of it is precious, sacrosanct natural areas that are no touch. They've got a lot of land that's also great for farming. They have a lot of land that they allow chemical farming to happen on. Right? There's a lot of land under easement that is industrially, chemically farmed right up to the edge of a waterway. So that's one of the weaknesses of the conservation movement. Right? You can conserve land, but does it substantially and measurably improve the ecological impact of how that land is being used? Not always. What it prevents is it from turning into a Walmart or a strip mall or cluster housing development. But it doesn't. You can have an easement on farmland that you still use pesticides, herbicides, and fungicides on, right? So what I'm also talking about here in this image is that each of these bioregions, we want to think about unique ways to build, unique ways, not just trying to be unique, but because they are unique, right? Each of these bioregions, and this becomes clear what I mean by this, if we just for a minute think specifically about some of the examples in the map here, right? The North Atlantic coast is going to have very different energy opportunities, maritime food systems, all kinds of ways that we're going to need to design buildings to make sense in terms of coastal flooding. As soon as we get into the High Allegheny Plateau, we've got very different design constraints. How do we need to design buildings there? What materials are available there? What types of crops make sense there? Right? There's 4,000 different plants that have been domesticated throughout human history. About 150 are widely cultivated, and just 4 provide 60% of the world's food, rice, wheat, soy, and corn, and much of that genetically modified and fed largely to factory farmed animals, right? So we go from 4,000 to 150 to 4. That's food insecurity, right? And this is part of the classic permaculture canon, is how that is a setup. And so as we regionalize, as we pursue implementing the solution to food insecurity, this type of scaled up design approach makes a lot of sense when you're asking a broader question about what is the goal of our design. Is our design simply to create food independent households, food independent eco villages and intentional communities? Or is it conceivable that we could do designs that show food independence for entire bioregions, entire watersheds? What does that look like? What does full diet year-round food supply look like? And again, this is simply to show this one. You can see if you squint and you look at the small print, you'll see it's the Department of Environmental Conservation. So typically bioregions, ecoregions, they're conservationists, they're biologists, they're regulatory agents, and they're using it mainly just to monitor and track what is in terms of existing ecological communities. They're not using this as something to say, let's design a new infrastructure. What does that look like, right? That's not the objective of it. And we'll find that studies like this that are like, oh, this was put out. I mean, glad they're talking about this. This is from Scott Stringer's office, Manhattan Borough President, where they're saying, what would it look like for New York City to go food independent within 50 miles of the city, within 100 miles of the city? Important conversation. However, the reason I'm showing this image is to show the mistake that it would make if it were used as a policy initiative. If we were to say, well, we're going to create tax incentives for every farm, every property that lives within 100 miles of New York City to stay green and to be something that could maybe produce food that gets shipped into the city, right? The problem with that would be that if you were on a train going up the Hudson Valley, it would be a totally artificial line. You would just suddenly, the landscape would look entirely different because you crossed that 100-mile line, that the city had stopped the greenbelt tax incentive at 100 miles, right? It needs to follow something more like bioregions, more like watersheds, not something like, are we 100 miles from the city, right? In something you could take a compass and just draw the line. Nothing geographic about that. A lot of the studies that these folks do, this is from Columbia University, on what would it look like for New York City to go food independent within 100 miles, you know, what's really funny about a lot of these studies is that none of them posit that we might be able to do anything to improve how people farm. They all, which of course to the permaculture community is amusing because it's like, that's entirely what permaculture is about, is how do we improve agriculture and make it more ecological, right? And so it's interesting that when we look at academia, which is something that I like to do to pull data from, so that as students study with me and as this audience, as you take these materials that we'll make available, you'll see this stuff is well-researched and well-funded, but it doesn't go far enough in terms of what's the actual setting for what this is, wanting to inspire as far as local food, right? The other reason why I picked this image that's interesting is this was before Irene came through the Northeast. And a pattern that I like to point out with this is that you'll see that, you know, five out of six of these farms are right in the riparian floodplain and tractor farming right up to the edge of a major waterway, which is clearly not a good plan, especially when you get 100-year and 500-year floods, right? So I think arguably the more important context to bioregion is watershed, and they are distinct and can be separate, meaning that a watershed can transect several bioregions. The Hudson River goes through several different ecoregions and bioregions. This is mapping watersheds. So here we're looking at two. It's a little blurry to tell you what we're looking at. It's a colored in pattern of land. It's showing us the geography. The blue is the Otter Creek watershed in Vermont, and it's showing all the land area that when rain lands on it, it ends up in Otter Creek or green in the Winooski, right? And this is a map. This is like a conceptual drawing that's used to say, how do you define watershed? I was saying they are distinct. They are delineated. It's topographical. It's based on ridges. And then watersheds are broken into sub-watersheds. So when we look at the Hudson watershed and New York City water system, here's a watershed. This is showing several watersheds with municipalities overlaying them. And you can see how they're not lined up, right? The reason we focused on the Rondout watershed is that, I thought I had an image right there, but if I don't, sorry. There'll be one coming up, is because it's the watershed that our municipality primarily lies within, right? Most of the municipality is in. How do we, this is a big watershed, the Connecticut River watershed. I just found this map revealing. I love maps. And to me, this is like astonishing that the Connecticut River watershed really is almost entirely in Vermont, right? It's the Connecticut River, but not much of it's in Connecticut. If you really look at who has the power to influence water quality in Connecticut, not even Connecticut that much, right? It's like they could be doing a ton of things right with water quality laws, with enforcement in Connecticut. But if people in Massachusetts and people in Vermont and New Hampshire, if they had more lenient water quality laws, or they even just had a few bad actors who were in non-compliance, then like it is going to substantially degrade the measures that are taken in Connecticut to improve their water quality. So this is why I'm saying, you know, thinking about watershed scale planning is important. Green belts. Green belts are just such a great idea, under championed, under kind of acknowledged. Another example of what I was talking earlier about, how do we get out in front of development? How do we come up with master plans that can prevent bad ideas from happening? And green belts, we'll see them in Northern Europe, especially well implemented. And they are the concept of protecting land with policy and with tax incentives to keep a certain amount of green space, usually with some kind of agro eco tourism kind of function to them, where you could ride a bike out and go work on a farm and work on the next chapter in your book in a little writer's cabin, and then come back on your bike into the city center and really make cities something that are thoughtfully connected with the outlying country in a way that is a plan that is protected. And this is an image from my book where I took the zones of use of permaculture design and just loosely sketched out what it might look like to take the zones of use and apply them at more of a regional scale. And part of why I decided to finish out putting together this schematic of what this looks like is because the more I thought about it, the more it felt like it really did hit on something that was useful, that I was finding there to be an inconsistency in my experience and in my view around conversations that are happening about the idea of, say, cities growing all their own food. Right? It's sort of a popular idea. The idea of it is much more popular than the amount of work that's actually being done doing it. It gets a lot of people. I'm often still encounter people who are like, well, what do you think about vertical farms and Despommier and that guy at Columbia who wrote about building high-rise buildings that are farms? I'm like, well, inherently it's a bunch of nonsense because new construction has such a crazy ecological footprint to create that how and in what world would it make sense in terms of food production to build a new building simply for growing food when you've got tons of existing infrastructure and buildings that could be retrofitted if your goal is to use buildings to grow food, which I also think is something from a design viewpoint that you really want to think carefully about and ask broader energetic questions like, does this make design sense? And what I mean by that is like, if I can float a barge from Vermont with no energy down the Hudson, and it's got really clean, healthy food that was grown far away from highly polluted cityscapes, and it floats into the docks of New York City and feeds New Yorkers, I'm not seeing why it is that we need to like knuckle down on trying to bioremediate factories so we can do aquaculture and fish farming in them if we have places that aren't sketch ball contamination land that aren't that far away. And it gets into these, to me, slightly theater of the absurd objectives where we get this notion like, well, what do you think about hydroponics? I'm like, well, what I think is like, if we're on a spaceship and we're not on planet Earth and we're asking questions about how we're going to grow food, then sure, a bunch of PVC piping with a bunch of circulating pumps and some liquid fertilizer. Okay. And because then we could use our own urine. We're on the spaceship. That's great. But fortunately, we're on a planet where there's actually a lot of land that isn't contaminated and isn't full of plastic and isn't in a place that's in chronic noncompliance with the Clean Air Act. I mean, much as I love the city and do a lot of design for the city, that's part of why it is I also have the wherewithal to say it's not necessarily right plant, right place to just broad stroke say, let's start trying to grow food anywhere and everywhere we can in the city. Maybe you got to get surgical about that type of objective because you could be creating a health hazard and a pollution vector that isn't actually very good for people, even though you grew that food really close at hand, right? So that's part of my thinking with this scaled up zones of use. It's to say cities are appropriate places, and in particular in the Northeast, for certain crops. And those crops we can outline broadly as the type of list you're seeing here listed, a lot of leaf crops, a lot of greens, herbs, places for nature connection, places for wildlife corridors. I often like to rank what we're doing with urban retrofit to create an explicit criteria where I'm saying to my students, the first thing you want to do is cool the city down because urban heat island effect is a real systemic problem that exacerbates a bunch of other problems, health problems, air quality problems, storm intensity, all can be connected to urban heat island effect. And we arguably could say in the Northeast, Washington, Philly, New York City, Boston, that getting too hot in the summertime is the main sickness of the city patient in the sense that that's when the air quality is worse. That's when energy consumption is highest because cities use more energy running air conditioning than they do keeping themselves warm in the wintertime, right? So first thing is cool the city down with extensive green roofs everywhere and anywhere you can. Extensive is easier, non-load bearing. It's thinner soils, extensive in contrast to intensive. Cool the city down. Second thing we want to do is mitigate combined sewer overflows, soak up water, extensive green roofs, rain tanks, deeper street tree pits. Third thing we want to do is nature connection, because per capita green space is lacking throughout our cities. Just somewhere for people to sit and see something green, hear the breeze, maybe have like a light solar powered or bicycle pump powered water fountain. You can hear the sound of water. And really, like fourth on the list, might be get a yield of something you're going to eat, right? Because first thing we want to do, cool the city down. Second thing, let's address stormwater CSOs. Third thing, let's create nature connection and green space for people, right? Fourth thing, if your site is appropriate for it, think about a food crop, right? But you've already got three other things to give you a reason to be gardening in the city, right? Cool the city down, deal with stormwater issues, and create something natural for you. So then, you know, in the burbs, grow things that are more like our zone two crops, where we're growing stuff like onions and beans and maybe getting somewhat into Three Sisters gardens and winter squash, right? We're not going to do micro dairy on rooftop farms, right? We're not going to do a lot of huge winter squash and potatoes on rooftop farms. And as we get more into rural areas, right, silvopasture, nut trees, the ever popular host wedding events, moneymaker for people who are outside of city areas. In zone four, coppicing, woodlots, beef cattle, larger operations. And zone five is wilderness. And it turns out that when you think about a lot of these urban centers, that is actually, loosely speaking, the pattern that we have. We've got the high density urban center. What crops make sense there? What are the types of reasons to garden? What can greening up the city do for the city and for the people, right? Zone two, the burbs are further out with slightly larger lot sizes for larger crops that take longer and aren't needed to be close at hand as much as our leaf crops and our more kitchen garden crops, right? And zone four and zone five, in fact, are the Adirondacks, are the Catskills, are the Allegheny National Forest. It is the case that we have these zones repeating at a broader regional scale. So the zones are useful at site-specific scale, backyard gardening, neighborhood gardening. But what I found interesting and fun to work with here was what it looks like to scale them up to a regional application. I like this graphic. You can see there were some permies in the house. We got slow it, spread it, sink it for what is recommended to do with the uplands, with the headwaters. And then the idea here broadly of, you know, let's conserve and avoid development in river corridors, you know, especially after it gets wiped out by a major storm event. Don't rebuild right in the gunshot lens of where, you know, it's going to get wiped out again, right? And then to identify where are the places to plan for new development. Because I think what's important is that we can say as a community group, we're not for growth and we're not against growth. We're more wanting to organize how growth happens, where it happens. What are we trying to grow? We want to create city-country connections. And rivers and streams are natural opportunities for this from a planning perspective. Take existing plans. This is a random image from a comprehensive plan for the village of Ellenville that I was using in a proposal to say to the village planners, hey, you already identified a mountain gateway, a marketplace, a civic square, and all the components we're recommending are the compost green jobs area in the mountain gateway, more of a food co-op in the marketplace area, and in the civic area, more of a youth center. Again, really thinking about non-motorized ways to connect high-density urban areas with outlying areas. And then what are things that can be growing along? This is a drawing from our book, where In Earth is Our Home. I'm showing the farm field side, which would have more productive agroforestry plantings, and then the rail trail side, right? And those were just some examples. That's a heart nut. That's a tri-grafted heart nut. That's a grafted hickory. And I'm saying these could be growing all along the rail trail. And we'll create what we're calling, I couldn't find less words to describe it than a regenerative agroforestry riparian buffer wildlife corridor. There's a lot of things going on. You know? There's a lot of working parts there. That's why this is a permaculture book. This book is meant for people who kind of already feel introduced to permaculture and are looking for something that takes it to that next level, that takes you to that level of like, wow, what would this look like to roll out as a broad initiative that we could. My hope is that people will find this inspiring to give them ideas that they want to take to their local planning board, that they want to take and talk about, have a book group at your library, at your local bookstore, and just talk about this stuff, because it's not a conversation that I think is happening enough. And what I'm wanting to do, what I created the book for, is to give that type of talking point an opportunity where people are looking for a way to get their community excited about permaculture. What does it look like to start to do this more? You know, and I get into these are what I wanted to do with these was have a lot of graphics. I have a lot of drawings in the book. I wanted to make it really graphic heavy. There's a lot of maps. There's a lot of new drawings, like the one I just showed you of expanding the zones of use to a broader regional scale. This drawing is a side view of how do we follow with natural succession, but interplant it with more utilitarian species as well as wild species. So the hickan is a hybrid of hickory and pecan for northern climates. Sweet chestnut, meaning Chinese or European, not so much focused on the American chestnut. And then other known actors, you know, apples, stone pine, hazelnut. So this is showing, like, what does it look like for the field forest edge to be extended? This is from a book I just want to mention. For listeners and viewers, it's a really excellent book that I think should be more of a primary text in permaculture, and it's called Regenerative Cities by Herbert Gerardet. And this is an image from that book. And Gerardet, Girardet, he's a counselor advisor to the United Nations, and he talks about the difference between a city, as he describes it at present, which is a petropolis, so utterly, completely dependent on petroleum, they couldn't exist without it. And his concept in regenerative cities is, what does it look like to transition to an ecopolis? And that's what this is a broad schematic of. Broader regional scales. Create cities we want to live in, not cities that we feel like we have to make a mass exodus from. As I mentioned, cool them down. Turns out, green technology like photovoltaics works better on a living roof. Create habitat, create wildlife corridors, and then maybe grow some food. In Shanghai, a city of 15 million people, 15% of them are growing 4,000 tons of food a day, 60% of the vegetable needs of the city. So, well, I'm saying, you know, let's give the qualifiers that are needed, let's also take inspiration from where it's available, right? And let's bring plants inside a building. That's an inimitably good idea that we'll find here. The crazy numbers, right? The EPA is saying that there's over 600 volatile organic compounds and that it's one of the top five causes of illness. Those two things are interconnected. Turns out when you bring plants in, the microbes at the root zone eat those volatile organics. This building has much less worker sick days, much less worker turnover. Solar thermal. So I talk a lot about alternative technology in the book. I have a whole chapter just on bioregional energy and dive into this technology because I think it's so important. Solar thermal. I mean, just quickly, these numbers, 600,000 people work building systems that still in this country are barely understood or applied. Think about the entire state of Florida. Think about the entire state of Arizona, Southern California. Think about how much of this country could be getting all of its domestic hot water from something that uses glass, not rare trace minerals that come from the Congo, to make solar thermal hot water panels, right? Plus, it's a direct domestic service you get from it. This isn't about a grid-tied technology that arguably may or may not benefit you, and probably not if the grid goes out, right? Solar thermal hot water is a direct domestic benefit that you get from this technology. Pen mounds, still vastly underutilized, but basically we can create compost piles to generate heat. And these are all topics that are in my book to explore how do we really practically begin to create a bioregional energy system? How do we get 3,380 tons of organics out of trash? How do we borrow ideas from Burlington, where there's 42,000 people that are grid independent and 100% renewable, and a pretty appropriate version of how they went about doing it. Large solar array at the airport, windmills that aren't oversized on a mountain ridge that was already impacted, as well as a steam to power plant. We dive a lot into biodigesters because I think they're fascinating. They've got huge potential. You can generate electricity, make hot water, and you've still got great finished biosolids for compost. This is part of what inspires me about it. When we look around the globe and we see that in China, 30,000 biogas plants are powering 40 million homes. You know, what are we doing? We need to get on top of these things. Solar thermal hot water integrated with biodigesters improves performance as well. We can place this stuff. Here's a lot of land that's available. 4,000 acres on 6,000 parcels of brownfields in New York City. And brownfields, in many cases, they're polluted, but not so polluted that you couldn't just pour a concrete slab on them and start business. That's often considered a legitimate path. So you could put your biodigester, put your solar thermal, put your photovoltaic array, all on. We've got 4,000 acres of real estate in the five boroughs. We're going to give Carl Hammer the job of being the national czar of compost because he is absolutely the master. I go and sit at his feet every time I teach in Vermont. A real wealth, really somebody who needs to be resourced much more seriously than he is. He's serious about his own endeavor, but I would say a vastly underutilized resource, educator, and inspiration that we need to be looking to throughout the country. I mean, 1,200 free-range heritage breed chickens lay 900 dozen eggs a month. And I mean, I've gone and kicked the tires on this. This is for real. He is not feeding these birds a drop of grain. All they are eating is food scraps from the city of Montpelier. And we think about the fact that this number here that I put on the pile, 60% of what ends up in landfills, 60%. We can be reducing the volume of what ends up in landfills. And that is what we're pushing for here to bring this full circle to where I started today. The landfill initiative here, what we're telling the county legislators and people here is no landfill at all, but especially not until you've fully diverted all the organics and all the materials that can be reused that are in the trash. You got to get that out, send it to biodigesters, send it to compost facilities like Carl Hammer, 41 million tons we can divert. In Calcutta, 26,000 people are employed just processing compost, right? So these are also diverse, interesting jobs that come out of this, where we can begin to really create cities we want to live in. We can clean up water. And I'm going to begin to wrap up here and just get to what my final message is here, which is we want to create a regionally adapted, self-reliant economy that provides a diversity of green jobs. And we're going to honor and remember our ancestors and remember to witness and experience the awe-inspiring power of the earth and tap into that. Just kick back and enjoy the ride and realize, like, this planet is ancient, primordial, powerful, going to continue on with or without us, and it's our opportunity to really tune in to what it is that our inheritance is and to contribute to it and to appreciate and be a witness of it.
Wow, Andrew, thank you so much. That was super inspiring. Just what I was hoping for to start off the whole summit, which is to give this really big overview and this like untapped area of permaculture, which is like, how do we do it at scale? How do we actually take all these little tricks and techniques that we know, tools, technologies, processes, scale them up, provide a meaningful living so we can kick back and enjoy the ride? Every permaculturist I know that's active in it is having more fun, right? Didn't David Holmgren said that? Joy, you know, collapse first, and like, we're having more fun anywhere down here anyway. We're drinking homemade this and that and growing all sorts of fun berries and interacting with animals and sun and seasons and all that.
Absolutely.
The question I have, I guess, is how, I think maybe the answer is like, start a small book group with your book with people locally around you. But how would you say, if somebody was really turned on by this application of permaculture, less so at the home scale or like the farm scale, but more like the bioregional scale. How would you think a person might reach out to people in their bioregional economy and start these conversations? Where would you point them?
I would point them to any local permaculture group that they might have. You know, if there are people in their community that identify or qualifying what they're doing as permaculture. I would also say oftentimes people who are interested in organic food, organic farming organizations are a place that you'll find like-minded people on this topic in watershed groups. So a local watershed group or local like land trust. And often land trusts and watershed groups will be named after people are wondering, like, well, how do I find one? You know, usually they're named by a geographic feature in your area. So they'll be named after a waterway or named after a preserve or something of that sort. So I would say networking with people in your community who are already engaged in thinking about your watershed, or thinking about natural areas, or thinking about local farming and organic farming. And what we've been talking about today is a really useful way to connect those different themes. How do people who are local farmers and local growers connect with the interests of watershed groups and land trust groups? And how do they start to set up more meaningful ways of collaborating and supporting one another? Like I was suggesting earlier, access to land is a big topic we'll hear coming up among growers. Most farmers are finding that to be a bottleneck part of their desire to farm. How do they get access to land?
Yep.
So if you're interested in helping to move that kind of topic forward, often connecting and networking with your local or as close to local as you can find land trust group will be a good place to start, and or local watershed group.
Yep.
And as I mentioned, you know, if there are permaculture meetups or permaculture groups around, they also would be a good place to network with.
Yeah, and I think your book provides a really important like center place, because sometimes, you know, you start talking about all, did you know we could have like sustainable buildings also and sustainable forested food systems? And, you know, like you get into all these things, whereas your book kind of is like, hey, let's just talk about this. Let's have a meeting about this. Let's just see what bubbles up in the group or what is maybe like my friend and colleague often says, what's the adjacent possible? So if you're working with the permaculture group already, you don't want to come in and just be like, hey, we got to do this bioregional economic master planning. But maybe what's the adjacent possible from your book that leads and draws that group, but also society, toward those bigger scale conversations? Well, Andrew, just with respect to your time and our time here, I'm going to have to let you go. I could talk to you all day. Thank you so much. Yeah, this was really wonderful. If people want to maybe get in touch with you or find out more or work with you or hire you, what would be the best contact information?
Email and andrewfaust12@gmail.com.
Okay.
And then also the website, permaculturenewyork.com. And there's a contact email through the website directly.
Okay,
perfect. I would recommend people go to the website because I've put a lot into that to make it a real resource. And so they'll find that there's a lot of enrichment available there. There's a curated video page that breaks the videos into things like greening the city, ecological consciousness, regional planning. And each of those categories, I've got 4 or 5 different videos in those topics.
Yep.
And then also I have a blog and a newsletter that goes more in depth into these themes of bioregional design and watershed scale planning. There's Perfect. Some articles in the blog from the local newspaper where I've been writing more of my activist, but also awareness pieces about solar fields going in on prime agricultural soils, one of my favorite topics to rant about. And then also, you know, stuff about the landfill. And so folks can get a sense of like, well, how does he engage with his local community through the press? Right. And I've been doing a lot of that. Like I write an op-ed probably once, at the least once a month, sometimes as often as once every 2 weeks.
Cool. I didn't know that. That
And it's
ties
been
back
nice.
into your media literacy sort of course that you were doing all those years ago.
Yeah. Yeah, it's been great. We're fortunate to have a local newspaper called the Shawangunk Journal. And I've struck up a nice rapport with the new editor there, and they like the material that I generate. So I'm keeping up with that rapport, and it's been hugely valuable. And at the end of my book, there's about five of those editorials that I wrote that I included in the book as well for folks.
That's great. So everybody go buy that book, Earth is Our Home. It's on Amazon. You can get it at Andrew's website as well. Support
Yes.
him in that way and elevate your own understanding by leveraging Andrew's work and study for all these 30 years. It's so great about books is we can just take what somebody else spent a lot of hours putting together and sort of absorb it quickly and innovate, move on, and put it into action.
Yeah, thank you. And come study with us because we're using the book as our foundation. So,
That's awesome.
Really appreciate the time and attention.
Yeah, our pleasure, Andrew. Thank you so much. Bye, everybody. We'll see you in the next one.
Thanks, Jesse. Thanks, Tina.
It's nice that PineNet is there to speak up and help network the permaculture movement. It's only capturing a fraction of the movement that are officially involved and our members. So, boy, if PineNet could get all the permacultures, or half of them, or a fourth of them, to all sign up and become working together, PineNet could just really do so much more.
Just every one of my 2,000 students and all the students that have been through the course, wherever they are in the world, have in some way made a profound impact. And we can do much more if we can link them up and support them strategically. So that's why I'm asking for support from PineNet. Thank you.